The following talk is from St. Michael's Fulwell, a gospel-centered community for Fulwell, Teddington, and beyond. Our passion is to see every life following Jesus. For more information, visit our website, stmichaelsfulwell.co.uk.
We're going to turn to our Bible reading now. So pick up a Bible nearby you. Whilst you're doing that, also, there's some handouts. If you're sitting in the central seats, there's some handouts. I don't think they're going to be rightly distributed. So if you've got a spare copy, sort of put up in your hand. If you haven't got a copy, wave your hands and say, I could do with one of those. And hopefully everyone who wants a handout will get a handout. Hopefully that all works itself out. And do turn to Luke chapter 14, page 1047. Luke chapter 14. And Kelly is going to come and read Luke 14, 1 to 11. Kelly.
Jesus at Pharisee's house. On Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, "If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?" And they had nothing to say. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, "Give this person your seat." Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, "Friend, move up to a better place." Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted.
Thanks very much, Kelly. Good evening, everyone. Nice to be here. I'm Sandy, and this is the fourth in a series called Choose Life. And I guess the series is about how our choices in life make a difference. What might seem like small variations in the way we handle things, in the end, make all the difference to our destiny. In my 20s, I lived in Japan, and quite early on in my time there, I hired a car. The map is about to appear. Up in the north, which is a very underpopulated, empty part of Japan, from Aomori, you can see on the top there. And I had a map, but it was all in Japanese, and all the road signs were in Japanese, and I couldn't read either of them. But I wasn't worried because we went over to the East Coast and we started going down the East Coast road, and the sea was always on our left, so we knew that nothing could possibly go wrong. Then, after several hours, suddenly the road stopped and there was just sea in every direction, and I knew that was impossible because there was thousands of miles of coastline. So I guess you can probably work out what happened. Somewhere near Aomori, we'd made a slight wrong turn, and if we look at the next map, we thought we were going down the east coast towards the Red Cross, but actually we were going up and round that peninsula towards the Blue Cross. And I can tell you it was a very, very long way back. The point is, what seemed like small choices make a very big difference to our destination. And in the end, we become the product of our choices. That's the scary thing you learn as you get older. Our little everyday choices shape who we become. If we don't handle power and success well, it will handle us. It will shape us into somebody who thinks power is the answer to everything, and who tries to control and manipulate others and get ahead and gain power. I'm sure we all know people who are driven by getting hold of power and position, and we can see how unattractive that is. And no one really wants to be like that. But people end up like that because they make small wrong choices, and it gets harder and harder to turn around. We're going to think about what happened one night when Jesus went to a prominent Pharisee's house for dinner. And I want to start by reflecting on three words that come up in this passage. There will be a fourth word later that's even more important, but let's think about these three first. Prominent in verse 1, honor or honored in verses 7 and 8, and distinguished in verse 8. Firstly, prominent, a prominent Pharisee's house. Nice to be prominent, isn't it? Someone important, influential, always at the center of the action. Very seductive when everyone wants to talk to you, everyone wants to know you, get close to you, prominent. Then in verse 7 and 8, honor. Jesus noticed how the guests picked the places of honor first. Well, of course they did. The most important places were at the center, close to the host, the position of power. The word Jesus uses here for honor means in first place. You're in the number one seat. You matter. And then in verse 8, a person more distinguished or esteemed or highly honored. Someone who's really made it. Isn't that what we want in life? For our lives to be a success, for everyone to say how well we've done. Prominent, honored, distinguished. We seem to naturally long for those things. Is that wrong? In every culture through history, people have sought prominence, tried to push themselves ahead of others. I had a friend who was a church worker, first in Liverpool and then in central London, a youth worker. And he said, it's interesting to compare Liverpool and London. In Liverpool, it was all about having the right clothing, looking good, having a cool outfit. In London, on the other hand, it's not about what you wear. It's about the school that you go to, the A-levels you get, where you go to college. Two different ways of being prominent and distinguished. Think about the effort we put into education. A writer called David Brooks called it the professionalization of childhood. From earliest years, he said, an alliance of parents and schools creates a pressure cooker of competition designed to produce students who excel at everything. He calls it a massive organic apparatus, a mighty achievertron. Maybe you're part of that achievertron, trying to be the best. Or maybe you feel like a victim of that craving for achievement and power. Unless you make it, you're a nobody. You don't matter. No wonder there's such anxiety around us. How do we handle this very powerful desire in us for success? People have been asking that question since the beginning of time, and it's not easy. So we need Jesus' wisdom here. Let me read from verse 7. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say, give this person your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you're invited, take the lowest place so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you'll be honored in the presence of all the other guests. One of the early liberal commentators says, Jesus is just offering us simple common sense here. If you start low, you can only move up. But if you aim too high, then you will come unstuck. This is a wise way to navigate social situations. Quite why Jesus would bother to come all the way from heaven to earth to give us a bit of advice about how to handle dinner parties, I'm not quite sure. No, Jesus is offering us something much, much more than that. Look at verse 11. This is one of the great spiritual laws. For all, so this is a universal law, all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Jesus is not telling us how to be savvy at dinner parties. He's telling us how the universe operates, its deep spiritual laws. Get this right and so much of your life will fall into place. But get it wrong and you're in trouble. And all of us, whoever we are, have to make little choices every day about how we handle power and position. Those choices shape us. Are we going to push ourselves forward, grab power, seek glory for ourselves? Because to do that, of course, we have to push other people back. We have to seek the first place instead of them. And that's not really how our Creator designed us to be, is it? It's not loving to grab the place of honor ahead of someone else. But on the other hand, Jesus says, if we humble ourselves, in verse 10, when your host comes, he will say, friend, move up to a better place. Then you'll be honored in presence of all the other guests. He's talking about the ultimate heavenly banquet at the end of all things. When your host comes, well, Jesus himself is the host at the great wedding banquet. That is when those who humble themselves will finally be exalted and raised up in the presence of all. Well, we'll think a bit more about that final banquet shortly. But because this is a great spiritual law, it's also true before we get there in our day-to-day lives. If you seek power and honor and push yourself ahead of others, it will reduce and damage you as a person. And I want to give you two examples. There are countless examples, but here are two of the damaging effects that power has on us. First, celebrity, and second, work. Celebrity. Someone called Cynthia Heimel, who is a showbiz correspondent in New York, wrote about what happens to celebrities. The moment a person becomes a celebrity is the same moment that he or she becomes a monster. She mentions three Hollywood stars she'd known before they became famous. Once they'd been perfectly pleasant human beings. But now they've become supreme beings, their wrath is awful. I don't know if any of you have seen the recent film A Complete Unknown. Timothée Chalamet plays the young Bob Dylan, and one of the key characters is Dylan's girlfriend, Susie Rotolo. Here's a picture of them. She's played by Elle Fanning in the film. And this is what the real Susie Rotolo said about Dylan becoming famous. It really changes a person when they become known by all and sundry. They develop this uncontrollable egomania. I can see it happening to Bobby. I've tried to tell him in so many ways, but it's useless. It really is. He's beginning to love me only in relation to himself. That's tragic, isn't it? But it's so hard not to be corrupted by power and success. Second example, work. I was talking to someone recently who works in human resources for a big city law firm. And she's been there for 30 years and she says, we see the same pattern over and over and over again. Young graduates come in, they're friendly, they're helpful, they're trying to get on with everyone, they're lovely people. And then after 2 or 3 years, they qualify as solicitors and they become what we in HR call the green-eyed monsters. Now they're a rank above the juniors. And they start to treat them badly and send them rude emails. Power changes them. They become the green-eyed monsters. And then, she says, about 10 or 15 years later, it happens all over again when they become partners. This time we call it partneritis. They start to treat everyone as if they, the partners, are the only people who matter. The green-eyed monster and partneritis. How hard it is to handle power well. How do we learn to do that? Well, this is where we need to understand the fourth word that Jesus uses at the end of verse 10. It doesn't stand out in the translation. It's translated as, then you'll be honored in the presence of all the other guests. But in fact, it's a different word from the ones used earlier. What he literally says is, then you will receive glory in the presence of all the other guests. This is at the final, ultimate wedding banquet. And the original Greek word is doxa. The Authorized Version translates it as worship. Then you will have worship in the presence of all. If we follow the great spiritual law and humble ourselves rather than chasing the world's honor and glory, this is what we'll receive, true heavenly glory. Now that word glory or doxa has two elements. The first is brightness, splendor, radiance, the glory that shone around when the angels appeared to the shepherds at Bethlehem. But that is just an outward manifestation of something much deeper, an inner beauty and magnificence, something wonderful and deeply right. Ultimately, glory is the very essence of God himself, his godness, you could say. Theologians down the centuries have struggled to define God's glory, maybe because it's kind of the culmination of all his attributes and goodness, his beauty and perfection and supreme value and weightiness. Maybe you know the Hebrew word for glory, kabod, literally means heaviness or weightiness. That's why Paul in 2 Corinthians talks about an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Glory is solid. It matters. And this is what we're made for. This is what life is ultimately about, sharing in the glory of God himself. It's why the Westminster Confession says man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. We're made to recognize and rejoice in that weightiness, that glory at the center of ultimate reality. And that explains why it's so basic to who we are as humans. This desire for significance, for power, is not wrong. It's what we're made for. That's why it's found in every human culture throughout time. But our mistake is we look for glory in the wrong place, in the temporary, unsatisfying things of this world. This is what it says in big letters at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. The game is about glory. If only, Spurs fans think. But real glory is not to be found in the petty baubles of this world. Is it in celebrity, in becoming a law partner, in winning the premiership? Those things are here one day and gone the next. One moment you're in the seat of honor and everyone's admiring you, and then suddenly someone more important comes along than you, kid on the block, and you're hoiked out of your place and sent down to oblivion. Humiliated, Jesus says. Don't be fooled by that passing temporary glory. Work for glory that cannot be taken away from you, that the host of everything, Jesus, will give you at the final wedding feast in front of everybody. C.S. Lewis said in his famous sermon, The Weight of Glory, in the end, that face which is the delight and terror of the universe must be turned on each of us with either the expression conferring glory inexpressible or the expression inflicting shame that can never be cured or disguised. Every little choice we make is leading us to one of those two destinations. And if you see how wonderful this eternal glory for Jesus to have his face shining upon you in that way is, you will never really be controlled by that other temporary stuff. You can take it or leave it. To use a silly illustration, once you've tasted the finest Burgundy, you won't be so entranced by Tesco vodka anymore. Here are all these people at a prominent Pharisee's house trying to grab the positions of power at the center of the table, so busy pushing themselves forward that they don't notice the Lord of glory himself standing quietly at the side watching what they do. And that's why verse 11 is the great spiritual law, because the Lord of all power himself made himself nothing, Philippians 2, took the lowest place, gave himself away for nothing. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Well, okay, you might say, well, I don't have loads of power. I'm not a celebrity. I'm not a top law partner. But I suggest to you that all our relationships and interactions have some sort of power imbalance, different levels of status and position, different ages and experience. We're always wrestling with how we handle power. And it's often the real issue in how we engage with each other. In his book, Counterfeit Gods, Tim Keller talks about someone in their church community who, before he became a Christian, tried to have sex with as many women as he could. And then he became a Christian and he stopped sleeping around. But in church meetings, he continued to always try and get his way, always try to dominate the meeting. And Tim Keller says his real idol wasn't sex, it was power. That's what the sexual encounters were about, controlling others. And when he became a Christian, he just transferred his craving for power and domination to church meetings. This desire in us for power, for glory, is very strong. And how do we get it under control? Well, we have to see that the Lord of glory himself gave it up for us. This passage starts with Jesus being carefully watched in a prominent Pharisee's house. And in front of him in verse 2, it says, is a man suffering from an abnormal swelling of his body. He asked the leaders and experts, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? But none of them will answer. They're all too scared of saying the wrong thing, of losing their power and position. But Jesus isn't afraid. He takes on the powerful people and heals the man. And ultimately, that confrontation with power will take him to the cross. The cross is the place of ultimate humiliation. That was its purpose. Crucifixion was designed above all to degrade and humiliate the person crucified. It was the ultimate insult to personal dignity. Look at the end of verse 9. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the lowest, the least important place. That's what he did for us. He humiliated himself that we might be exalted to a place beyond our wildest dreams or imagination. And once we grasp that deep in our soul, we're no longer controlled by our desire for petty, passing human power and glory. Now we have seen where it really lies, the right place, and we don't have to trample on others to try and get to the cross. It doesn't mean, of course, as Christians, we shouldn't aim to do well. It's good to have Christians in senior positions. But if we get to those positions, our motivation must be completely different. We're no longer controlled by power. We can give it up if we need to. Well, I'm pretty much done. But before I finish, I just want to say something about political power. I can't talk about power without saying something briefly about politics. When Jesus came, the Lord of all of the earth, he refused political power. The devil offered it to him in the temptations, but he said no. Where did he first reveal his glory? In Rome, the center of political power? No. In Jerusalem, the center of religious power? No. He revealed his glory, John tells us, in a tiny village in Galilee called Cana, which is so small, we actually don't know where it was. He did it so quietly that no one noticed, except his disciples. And yet that was, John tells us, the revelation of his divine, unimaginable glory. That's our humble Savior. He held no political power, but in his gentle humility, he changed the world more than any political leader who's ever lived. Mary said in her song, he's brought down the rulers from their thrones and lifted up the humble. He is truly the great revolutionary. In the end, political revolutions don't really change things. They kick one lot out of power and put another lot in, but the same problems always recur over and over again. But Jesus didn't get elected, he got executed. He humiliated himself, took the lowest place so we could be exalted to the highest place. He is the true revolutionary who overturns everything. And when you see that, it creates a real revolution in the place that matters, in your heart. You start to care for the vulnerable, to raise up the lowly. Nothing else, I suggest, can produce that kind of revolutionary change deep within you. This is my favorite quote on power and politics from Samuel Johnson, the guy who wrote the first dictionary 250 years ago. And he said this: "How small of all that human hearts endure, that part which laws and kings can cause or cure." By laws and kings, he means power, government. Laws don't change hearts. How small of all that human hearts endure, that part which laws or kings can cause or cure. In our post-Christian culture, we find ourselves passing more and more laws to try and control what people say or even think. Currently going through Parliament is the Crime and Policing Bill, and it contains 18 new criminal offences and 13 new police powers. It will bring in things called respect orders, designed to make people respect others. Is that going to work? Force and power don't really change the heart, do they? You don't make people tolerant by passing laws telling you to be tolerant. How small that part which laws and kings can cause or cure. What changes us is grasping the great spiritual law that those who humble themselves will be exalted. And the early church was a truly revolutionary community. They cared for the poor and vulnerable. They offered a new family to orphans and widows that no one else wanted. They looked after the sick when the plagues hit the city and everyone else left town. People of very different social backgrounds and ethnic origins came together. Divisions were healed. The prosperous shared their money with the poor. It wasn't just a new spiritual community, it was an entirely new culture. And it was so attractive that it gradually transformed a brutal, power-based empire. That is the real revolution that no political power could ever achieve. How small that part which laws or kings can cause or cure. So our choices, small and great, on how to handle power will make us day by day into the people we become. Those who exalt themselves will sooner or later be humbled. And those who humble themselves will be exalted. If you get that spiritual law deep down into your soul, then your life and your relationships will go well. And you will create a mini revolution that blesses everyone around you. So let's pray. Lord, help each one of us when we face little decisions about power. Help us to remember you're making yourself nothing, taking the lowest place for us, for me. And just help us, Lord, to make those little decisions wisely, to care for others, and to seek the only glory that matters, the glory that you will give us at that final banquet in your grace and mercy. Amen.